There may not be a more important issue facing Alaska right now than in Cook Inlet with the beluga designation.
Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan maps out a strategy for dealing with the Endangered Species Act. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 31st. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the best Nordic skiers in the country descend on Anchorage.
It will be a long time before you see this level of skiing in Anchorage again.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
The captain and second mate of the tugboat Pathfinder have been relieved of their duties as a result of the tugboat's grounding last week on Bligh Reef in Prince William Sound. Crowley Marine operates the tug, which was scouting for ice along Alaska's oil shipping lanes December 23rd, when it ran aground, spilling an estimated 100 gallons of diesel fuel. Crowley says the two crew members, whose names have not been released, are not being paid. The company says it is waiting for the outcome of a Coast Guard investigation to determine any further action. A Canadian natural gas pipeline between Alberta and the Mackenzie River Delta took a big step forward yesterday when an independent panel appointed by the government to look into the social and environmental impacts of the project recommended that it go ahead. In fact, the joint review panel said the area would be better off with the project than without it. But it wants strict conditions to make sure of that. One of those conditions could result in aiming the Mackenzie gas line at the same market that's the target of two competing proposals in Alaska. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
The seven-member joint review panel has been working on its report since 2004. After extensive hearings along the proposed 750-mile gas line route and elsewhere, it concludes that the project offers a way to a sustainable future for the Northwest Territories region. That's a lot different from what Canadian federal judge Thomas Berger recommended after 2 years of hearings there in 1977. He said the whole thing ought to be held up until native land claims in the area are settled, and that killed the prospect. This time, Imperial Oil and its partners have worked out a joint ownership deal with the Aboriginal Pipeline Group, representing all but one of the First Nations, the Detcho. The report now goes out for comment and then goes to Canada's National Energy Board for permitting action by September of this year. The panel's 176 sweeping recommendations require other federal actions on land conservation, energy policy, and on a $500 million impact fund. It's not clear that the federal government in Canada is ready to move on those things or on financing incentives for the pipeline's promoters. The panel wants the gas line to fit into a national strategy in Canada to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It wants the government to commit within 3 years to using the gas as a transitional fuel towards a, quote, sustainable low-carbon economy. More specifically, it calls on the government to, quote, ensure that cleaner natural gas is used to replace and not augment more carbon-intensive and polluting fuels. This is a provision that's likely to change the business assumptions of the industry, which up till now has been assuming that should the Mackenzie line be built, most of its output would likely be used to cook more fuel out of Alberta's vast tar sands. This recommendation would bar that sort of use. Imperial said that the report was, quote, positive and encouraging. Its stock went up on the Canadian stock market. ExxonMobil, the majority owner of Imperial, is keeping mum on the report until it's analyzed. A couple of years ago, Exxon Chairman Rex Tillerson said the project had gotten too expensive. Its current price tag is about $15 billion. Interestingly, TransCanada has not made a comment either. TransCanada has the state contract for incentives for a gas line to Alberta from Alaska, but it's also a part owner in the Aboriginal Pipeline Group. If both schemes are chasing the same market, the 4-year delay in getting the Joint Review Panel report out may have given the Alaska project a head start. TransCanada is due to start looking for customers for its pipeline this June in a so-called open season required by federal regulators, You want to be sure a pipeline has customers before they will issue permits to build it. Then in fall will be an open season solicitation from the competing Denali pipeline plan. BP and ConocoPhillips are involved with that one, while Exxon is thrown in with TransCanada. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel.
Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan met yesterday with the mayors of the Kenai Peninsula and Matanuska-Susitna boroughs to discuss and plan their responses to the proposed federal designation of Cook Inlet as critical habitat for the area's beluga whales. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
On December 1st, the Federal National Marine Fisheries Service announced it was considering designating some 3,000 square miles of the Cook Inlet beluga's known local range as critical habitat. At yesterday's meeting, Mayor Sullivan says he regards the possible designation as a major danger to the city and the region.
There may not be a more important issue facing Alaska right now than both what's happening up north with the polar bear designation and in Cook Inlet with the beluga designation.
Sullivan, flanked by Mayor Dave Carey of the Kenai Peninsula Borough and Mayor Talis Kohlberg of the Matanuska-Susitna Borough, was making a case for state money to fund scientific research on the Cook Inlet beluga. Carey, like the other two mayors, contends that there's not been enough scientific research on the local beluga to declare their Cook Inlet range as critical habitat.
The current population is what we need the data on, and most agree they don't have it. It seems to me before you make a decision to protect the 300, you need to know the demographics of where they calf, where they eat, where they winter, and the life cycle in terms of the age. I would feel much more comfortable if they made a decision based on true knowledge as compared to some speculating based on information that is a decade and a half old.
The mayors worry a federal critical habitat designation will hurt, perhaps even stop, resource development as well as stifle current activities in the Cook Inlet area. Mayor Sullivan cited municipal wastewater discharges into the inlet, which operate under a special permit, plus concerns about the port expansion and maintenance, energy development, and even noise levels from the city's two airports. Carey had a long list as well, including Kenai gas and oil projects, fishing and tourism, and erosion control. Mayor Kohlberg noted that while the Matsu port is currently permitted, in the future it might encounter difficulties. The mayors agreed to coordinate their efforts toward the critical habitat designation. That includes pushing for an extension of the public comment period, as well as seeking at least one local hearing on the proposal. Sullivan says the city is not against protecting the Cook Inlet beluga, but he does not want Anchorage to experience an economic crisis because of the designation.
You can have that endangered designation, but you can also get waivers for industrial areas, for developing areas, for shipping areas. And so that's our first goal, is to make sure that that designation does not impact our ongoing operations.
Even so, Sullivan says, projects can become bogged down in lawsuits that delay or stop them. Bob Shavelson, executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper, says that is an overblown fear.
If a project is properly designed, it's not going to have an inordinate impact on water quality or habitat. It moves forward without litigation. It's only the things that are short-sighted that shouldn't go forward in the first place that might stumble over litigation. So I think that's a lot of arm-waving, sky-is-falling rhetoric that the opponents are pointing to.
Sullivan also said the city is hiring a special advisor, William Stell, with the legal firm K&L Gates of Seattle. Stell worked for a federal agency dealing with endangered species before joining the law firm. Stell will help coordinate the municipality's response and, if necessary, help seek mitigation should the critical habitat proposal be established. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The state administration has filed objections to the proposed federal designation of a more than 200,000 square mile area as polar bear critical habitat. The proposal is required now that the polar bear is listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. In comments filed with the Department of Interior's Fish and Wildlife Service, State Attorney General Dan Sullivan compares the proposed area to the size of the state of California. Sullivan says by law, the critical habitat designation should balance the concern for the species with concern for the economic impacts posed by the designation. Sullivan says that has not been done in this case. He says Fish and Wildlife has included areas lacking special features and has ignored protections already in place for polar bears under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. But Bruce Woods, spokesman for the Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska, says the critical habitat proposal is designed to cover all the bears' terrain.
The service proposed that area because our biologists felt that the various components of habitats that polar bear need to survive are encompassed by the three separate categories, sea ice, coastal islands, and onshore denning habitat that are included in that critical habitat proposal.
Woods says the state's official comments will be taken into consideration before any final decision is made on the critical habitat. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a surprise obstacle for the U.S. Olympic cross-country ski team.
The rules changed, and that kind of threw a kink in things.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Nordic skiers from across the nation will compete in Anchorage starting Saturday in the U.S. Cross Country Ski Championships. The races take on added importance this year because they'll help athletes qualify for a spot on the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic teams. Rachel Steer is the Assistant Chief of Media for the U.S. Cross Country Championships. Steer is a former Olympic biathlete herself, and she visited our studios to give us the upshot on the competition.
These four races are key selection factors in determining the U.S. Olympic team, the team that will go to Vancouver in February. They've been racing for the last year, trying to get their best performances in, and this is the skiers' last chance to really put a top performance in there and hopefully gain a spot on that Olympic team.
Why was Anchorage selected as the site for the qualifying races?
Well, Kincaid Park has a fantastic network of cross-country ski trails. We have over 50 kilometers of groomed trails just out there at the park. We have a wonderful venue, and not only that, we have an amazing group of volunteers who have been working hard for more than 2 years. So Anchorage and the Nordic Ski Association did put in a bid to host these ski championships. And the fact that our trails meet a certain criteria and standard in terms of difficulty, climbs, and technical difficulty, and distances, and of course the fact that we have a very strong ski culture here in Alaska really helped us win the opportunity to host these races.
How many skiers are expected?
Right now we have more than 300 athletes registered to compete. This is including America's top cross-country skiers. So we're talking about the World Cup racers like Keegan Randall and Chris Freeman and Andy Newell. And we've got Lars Flora from Anchorage, Holly Brooks. We've got people coming from the lower 48 who are racing on the U.S. Super Tour Series. They're traveling around the U.S. all winter long competing in cross-country races. They're all coming up here to race head-to-head.
Wow.
It will be a long time before you see this level of skiing in Anchorage again.
Would not, like Keegan Randall, already be assured a spot on the team?
You could say that, but Keegan, we all know, is a very competitive person. I'm sure she'll go to the start line this week with the goal of going out there and winning.
Are these races the determining factor in whether they'll be on the team or not?
Officially, nobody has been named to the cross-country team. I think there are some assumptions that we can make about who has already qualified, but nothing is set in stone, and it won't be until after these races are done.
Now, the Olympics actually start in 2010, right?
Correct, in February.
In British Columbia?
In Vancouver.
Vancouver. So this is sort of getting down to the wire then, isn't it?
It is. And sometimes people forget these races are a chance for athletes to highlight all the efforts that they've put in. But it's really been years and years of hard training and sacrifice that these athletes have made to get to this point. And this is their chance to shine. And this is their last chance to make a bid for that Olympic team.
Well, last year, the weather played a factor, the extreme cold. How about this year? The weather is not extremely cold, and we do have a lot of snow, but I'm hearing at Kincaid maybe the snow isn't that great.
Oh, actually, the skiing is pretty darn good right now. We have full snow coverage out on all the trails out at Kincaid. The grooming crew is out there making sure that that the trails will be groomed appropriately. And even last weekend, we had the Nordic Ski Association hosted a big shovel party. So we moved extra piles of snow that were on the sides of the trail to just add a little bit to that base of snow. So that should not be an issue this year. Of course, we can never control what the temperature is doing, but as far as I can tell, it doesn't look like we have a super cold spell heading our way. You never know when a volcano might erupt, but we're all crossing our fingers about that one as well.
Can the public come see? How's that going to be arranged?
All events are free and open to the public. And spectating at Kincaid is really fun. These courses, a big part of the course design was with the spectator in mind, especially the sprint races, which are the first and last days of competition. So on Saturday, January 2nd, there's a skating or freestyle sprint race out at Kincaid. And a major portion of that sprint course is visible from the stadium area. So it's very exciting. Here you have heats of 4 to 6 athletes starting head-to-head, racing around this short course. First two people across the line qualify for the next round, and you can stand pretty much in one place and watch the entire thing.
Rachel Steer is Assistant Chief of Media for the U.S. Cross Country Championships. The races start Saturday in Anchorage and continue through next week. Anchorage racer James Southam will be one of the skiers to watch at Kincaid next week. Southam is a distance specialist who went to his first Olympics in Italy in 2006 and is hoping to make the team again this time around. But it's turning out to be more of a nail biter than he was expecting. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
James Southam thought making the Vancouver Olympic team would be relatively easy. This spring, he was riding high after his best season ever.
Then the rules changed, and that kind of threw a kink in things.
That rule change means the U.S. team will have about half of the Olympic spots for cross-country skiing as it did in 2006. Last time, 17 athletes made the team. This time, there will be about 8 skiers total. The drastic reduction is due to a change in a complicated international formula that hits the U.S. team especially hard.
It was frustrating for sure. I mean, pretty much everybody had expected it to be the way it was in previous Olympics and the way it was at World Championships last year. And then it's like, whoa, you know, we've got less than half of the starting spots we did in 2006. And as a ski country, we've improved. So that was just a big surprise.
But cross-country skiers are used to dealing with challenges they have no control over, like the weather. And Southam has a good attitude about confronting this type of obstacle. Over the years, he's established himself as one of the best distance cross-country ski racers in the country. He says making the Olympic team in 2006 was a surprise. And after it was over, it wasn't difficult to decide to stay in the sport for another 4 years.
It wasn't tough. It was like I finally got up to the level where ski racing kind of becomes fun, where you start doing World Cups, you start doing big championships. And yeah, when I left the Olympics in 2006, I didn't ski nearly as well as I'd hoped there. And I just told myself that, and I think I told the U.S. coaches at the time, it's like this one was for practice, the next one's for real.
Following the Torino Olympics, Southam had a few difficult seasons. He calls the World Championships in 2007 a disaster. He decided he needed to turn things around.
So I made some big changes to my training. Felt I needed to do something drastic if I wanted to get faster. And made a little too drastic of a change and was just fried. Just trained way too hard and was just tired and flat the whole season. And then last year kind of rebounded from that and had my best year ever by a ways.
Southam has a few more tense weeks ahead of him before he knows for sure whether or not he'll be on the Olympic team. The U.S. is planning to make the announcement January 19th, with not much time to spare until the games start on February 12th. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Permanent fund dividend applications will be available online at midnight. This is the first year PFD booklets will not be mailed to every Alaska household. PFD Division Director Deborah Bitney says the booklets were not an efficient way to reach dividend applicants.
The whole idea behind it was to spend those dollars that we were wasting mailing a booklet to roughly 450,000 people who were filing online into a media campaign to remind Alaskans to file, because thousands of people every year forget. And that booklet was not an effective or efficient way of reminding people to file.
76,000 households that applied for a dividend by mail this year will still receive a booklet in 2010. The dividend application period ends on March 31st. This is the second year Alaskans can contribute some of their dividend to eligible charitable and educational organizations, community foundations, and the campuses of the University of Alaska. About $545,000 was donated this year through the Pick, Click, Give program.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at pennair.com. Connect with Alaska businesses seeking qualified Alaskans for hundreds of jobs in oil and gas, healthcare, and dozens of other career fields by visiting Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. When you register at alexsys.alaska.gov, your experience and qualifications will be matched with real-time job postings from Alaska employers. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Tonight is the blue moon, and as KDLG's Celeste Novak reports, much of the mystery around the blue moon is folklore.
The blue moon has an illustrious reputation. The words blue moon have been used to name a variety of things, from songs to beer and software to cafes. Blue moon has a connotation of something special or rare, but oddly, it is neither. The usage of the term blue moon has been around for hundreds of years, but the meaning has changed. Palmer Bailey is known as the Stars and Rocks guy, and he used to teach at the University of Alaska.
In the past, they've been as two full moons occurring within the same season, or four of them within the same three-month period. The current definition of a blue moon is usually accepted is that there are two full moons within one calendar month.
With that comes a mathematical formula to determine how many blue moons will appear in any given year, and even more specifically, when these moons will land on an auspicious date, such as New Year's Eve, which is the case for our last day of 2009. So, is it magic? Maybe not. But it never hurts to believe the blue moon on New Year's Eve will cast a spell for a magical 2010. And I'm waiting, looking for a new blue moon. In Dillingham, hoping for a little magic under the blue moon, I'm Celeste Novak.
The double full moon this month is rare, but to top that, Alaskans got to see a partial eclipse of the moon this morning. Travis Rector is an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He says the partial lunar eclipse could be seen best in the far north.
If you are very far to the north, where the moon would not set, then yes, you could see it.
Clear skies in Anchorage made viewing the eclipse possible in some locations. Rector says the partial eclipse started before 10 this morning and reached its maximum around 11:20. So in some parts of the state, the moon had already set. Rector says the phenomenon is caused by the Earth's shadow on the moon.
The lunar eclipse occurs when the moon passes in the Earth's shadow. So basically it passes behind the Earth as seen from the sun. So the Earth blocks sunlight, and then the moon will turn a dark red. This is what's called a partial lunar eclipse, where the moon just passes through the edge of the Earth's shadow, and it will cause the moon to get slightly fainter, but it's a very subtle thing, and it occurs very gradually.
Although only a few Alaskans got a good look at it, Rector says Alaska is the only place in the U.S. that the eclipse was visible at all. People living in Europe and Asia had a better vantage point for the lunar event. The coming of the new year ushers in a plethora of parties. Our roving reporter, Bob Babel, was able to finagle his way into a traditional Alaskan celebration.
This is Bob Babel, babbling on the scene reporter, having gotten in without an invitation to the party of the year. Everyone's here, even those who aren't. Look, it's Representative Don Young. What do you have to say to the press tonight?
It ain't me, B.
And it's Senator Lisa Murkowski. Senator, how do you like Washington, D.C. compared to Alaska?
The lights are much brighter there.
And Mark Begich, how do you like being a senator now?
I'm hungry for those good things, baby.
Look, it's former VCO chief Bill Allen. What's on your mind?
Lock me away.
Speaking of the law, it's some of the organizers of the movement to legalize marijuana. I haven't seen you lately. Where have you been? And it's Commissioner of Revenue Pat Galvin. What occupies your thoughts these days?
Yes, yes, yes.
And Governor Sean Parnell, how do you account for your growing popularity?
I'm not.
Speaking of our former governor, it's Sarah Palin. What do you have to say to the media these days?
One of these days, are gonna walk all over you.
And it's the top dog himself, President Barack Obama. What's on your mind today, Mr. President?
Why is everybody always picking on me?
And there you have it. This has been Bob Babel, Babbling on the Scene reporter, reporting on the scene, wishing you all a happy new year.
And that's all for this edition of Alaskan News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, and Celeste Novak in Dillingham. Bob Babel's producer is Jeff Brown in Juneau. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Ellen Lockyer. Happy New Year.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
AlaskaDispatch.com, reporting from across the state using multimedia and citizen journalism online to tell the story of our state. Find your Alaskan news at AlaskaDispatch.com. The Alaska Engineering Fund, whose members include USKH Incorporated, a multidiscipline design firm offering architecture, engineering, planning, and environmental services. Information online at USKH.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.